Well, good afternoon to everyone. Thanks for coming out today. We did get quite a bit of snow out in the Vail Valley this past week, as was could be witnessed by the long line of skier traffic headed up I-70. Thankfully, we were headed in the opposite direction here, and we had pretty smooth sailing. So, my kids made the trip with me. Now, Alden and Miles, you know, they've been back in school for about 3 weeks, I think, since their winter break. They had Monday off for Martin Luther King Day. And I'm involved in a carpool group in my neighborhood with two other families where one or two afternoons a week I'm responsible for bringing, you know, my son and two other seventh grade boys back from the charter school. And I always like to engage them when we're driving home, like, well, what did you learn at school today? How did your day go? I remember one time this past month when I asked them that, and I think I heard a couple groans from the back seat. Remember, these are 13-year-old boys. So I said, well, Miles, you know, what classes did you have today? He said, the usual. I'm like, well, what does that mean, the usual? You know, what specific classes did you have? He said, well, we had math. Without missing a beat, his friend kicked in, yeah, math. Mental abuse towards humans. His other friend kicked in, school. You know, S-C-H-O-O-L. 7 cruel hours of our lives. So that reminded me of the words of William Shakespeare, where he says, you know, all the world's a stage. All the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts. And then Shakespeare lists the 7 ages of man. At first the infant, mewling and puking in his nurse's arms. And then, I think this would apply to these boys, then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. Nice to see that nothing has changed in 4 centuries, at least in that area. Well, to introduce the topic I'd like to share with you all today, I recently purchased this book. It's entitled Stop Mass Hysteria. Now, this is about the current political climate in our country, about current events. And I usually don't gravitate toward books of this nature. You know, they tend to be rather negative and rather depressing. But this one sounded interesting to me. And as I opened this book up to chapter 1 and page 1, I read the following. He writes, hatred is in the air. We are living in an age of hate in which mental pollution is worse than air pollution. The most accessible and comprehensive of all unifying agents, hatred is spreading like a virus into all too willing hosts. Now, under normal circumstances, this coming week, normally we would have the State of the Union address given by the President to the Joint Houses of Congress. With the partial government shutdown, if you've been following the story, the House Speaker refused to let the President address the Congress. And I don't know where that stands right now. I think they tried to make some kind of agreement yesterday. But to me it just shows how divided, how partisan this nation has truly become. You know, the latest Beyond Today magazine has some excellent articles, and hope you had a chance to read the editorial by Mr. Ashley, where he writes, can a nation commit suicide? I'll just quote one line from what he wrote. Today, the United States stands at a crossroads, bitterly divided, not only over its future, but also over its past. A cultural war is underway in which clear battle lines have been drawn. Well, you can see that division. You know, if you tune in cable news, you know, you can see it from the news commentators. You can see it on the late night TV shows like The Tonight Show, the so-called comics, and their political monologues. And it seems like lately, even people in Congress seem to want to get in on the act of expressing this spirit of hatred. I saw a clip not too long ago where a congresswoman was outdoors at a rally, and she was addressing her supporters. And here's what she said, and I quote, "If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gas station, you get out and you push back on them. Tell them they're not welcome anywhere anymore." Well, the author of this book, and it's very recent, just came out a few months ago, commented on that. And he said, where is the outrage? More importantly, where is the humanity? Where is the decency? It is gone. It is lost in a sea of mass hysteria that dominates our world in a way and at a level that history has never before seen. Let's take a look at the New Testament. By the way, I'll have all these verses up on the screen if you want to follow along there. In light of what is happening in our country today, let's consider this end time prophecy. The Apostle Paul is writing, and this is in the New Living Translation. He says, "You should know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be very difficult times. For people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to their parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. They will be unloving and unforgiving, or as the King James Version puts it, without natural affection. Cold, heartless, without compassion, without empathy. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good." Well, brethren, during the sermon today, I'd like to take a look at a few Bible prophecies in relation to the year that we've just started, the year of 2019, which is unfolding ahead of us, and also take a look back at Bible prophecies that I think have been very, very clearly have been fulfilled. Now, at the end of each year, say December 31st, if you were to tune in, you know, one of the major news channels, you might come across a program that would be about the year in review. We watched one of those on CNN, and it listed as the top stories in 2018. The California wildfires, you know, scores of people were killed, and, thousands left homeless. There was a small town called Paradise up in Northern California, which had virtually wiped off the map. Mass shootings at a high school in Texas, in Florida, at a nightclub in Thousand Oaks, California, and in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. You know, the commentator on that program mentioned that it seems like Americans are becoming numb to this kind of tragedy. And then there was the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. This past year was certainly a time of upheaval in our national government. Can you help me here for a second? Technical expert here. It's great having preteens and teens in the house to show you how technology works. It's all right if you can't get it. I'll look back. You know, to add some perspective to all these, you know, stories of 2018, you know, if we were to get into a time capsule today and go back 50 years in time to the year 1969, what would we see? You know, not too much has changed. Like today, the 60s were also a time of great social upheaval. In January of 69, a new president was sworn in, Richard Nixon. Now, one of the crises he faced right from the outset was the civil rights crisis. Martin Luther King had been assassinated the year before, in 1968, and riots broke out in big cities around the country, Detroit, Atlanta, Newark. 50 years ago, in 1969, America was deeply divided over the war in Vietnam, with massive anti-war protests breaking out on college campuses around the country. Now, on a more positive note, 50 years ago, in 1969, the Plain Truth magazine, a magazine of understanding, just watch that for me, and make sure they're all coming up right. Plain Truth magazine was being sent out to hundreds of thousands of homes, not only in America, but around the world. And what I believe is an end time warning and an end time witness. Of course, in the United Church of God, we have the opportunity to carry on with that work today with the publication of Beyond Today. Now, 50 years ago, also, the country was in the midst of a cultural upheaval. In August of that year, 500,000 teenagers, many of them with very long hair, crowded into a small farm in upstate New York. Was known as the Woodstock Music and Art Festival. You know, they came to hear performers like Joan Baez and Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. It almost seemed as if a new era had begun. You know, an era of teenage drug taking and teenage immorality. You know, heavy metal, hard rock music began to dominate youth culture. Time magazine published a cover story where they asked the question, is God dead? Now, you remember that verse we just read in 1 Timothy where it talked about scoffing at God. Of course, as we all know, God is alive and well. Time magazine, from what I understand, is struggling for survival these days. But amidst all this upheaval and unrest, something pretty amazing happened in 1969, that summer. The first man landed on the moon. July 20th, 1969, the Apollo 11 mission, led by Neil Armstrong, made him the first human to set foot on the moon. Those famous words, that's one small step for a man and one giant leap for mankind. Now, there's an interesting film out at the theaters just a month or two ago, which I don't know if anyone here had the chance to see it. It was called First Man. It was starring Ryan Gosling, and it was very interesting from the standpoint of you see this and it really helps you to feel what it might be like if you or I were to be strapped into a tiny space capsule sent hurtling into outer space at unimaginable speeds. You know, this film explored the human sacrifice and the human cost involved in putting a man on the moon. Now, as we relate all this to Bible prophecy, back in the era of
Darius the Mede, who was a Persian king, Daniel the prophet was given a vision. He was given a prophecy of what it would be like at the end of the age. Let's take a look at that. It's in Daniel 12 and verse 8. And it is interesting that Daniel himself was not really clear about what this vision meant. Daniel 12 and verse 8. He says, "Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, 'My Lord, what shall be the end of these things?' And the angel said, 'Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end.'" So we're told that the meaning of these things would become clearer at the end of the age. Now let's drop back to verse 4. Daniel 12 and verse 4. And I think what follows here is certainly a pretty good picture of the age we live in today. Again, he's told, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro." Well, think of Neil Armstrong going to the moon and back. Or if you were to go to Denver International Airport any day of the week, any month of the year, minute by minute, you'll see flights taking off, departing. You know, many are running to and fro. In the second part of this verse, "And knowledge shall increase." Of course, you look at the explosion of knowledge that the internet age has brought over the past 25 years. Now, recently I discovered something on the internet. It's called the Google Translate app. Maybe some of you are familiar with that. I never knew about it before. But it's a free service offered by Google that translates words or phrases or even entire web pages from English into over 100 different languages, and it does so instantly. So I thought I'd have some fun with this app while preparing this message. And I typed in Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." I said, well, let's see what that might sound like in Somali. "Rabigu wa ila jira u anigu ma dunayo." Psalm 23. So I said, well, let's go to a different region. Let's try Samoan. Of course, American Samoa is an island down in the South Pacific. "Ole ali o lau, leo leo mamo, au tele manao." My apologies to anyone who might be Samoan here. The point is, we live in an age of rapid technological advances. And as Herbert Armstrong used to say, man's spiritual development has just not kept up. You know, man's ability to get along with his fellow man has not kept pace, has not matched these scientific developments. Well, for the next point that I'd like to address with you, I'd like to ask us to get in the time capsule once again from 1969, and I'd like for us to go back another 30 years to the year 1939, 80 years ago. Now, as students of history will know, on September 1st of 1939, Nazi Germany, under the leadership of the ruthless dictator Adolf Hitler, invaded Poland, marking the beginning of World War II. And in connection with this, I'd like to have us look next at Jesus' own words, his own prophecy, again, of what it would be like at the end of the age. This is in Matthew 24. We'll look at verse 6. You know, Jesus here is sitting on the Mount of Olives with his disciples outside Jerusalem. And they're asking him, Lord, what will be the sign of your coming? The end of the age. And among other things, Jesus said, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. He goes on to speak of famines and disease epidemics. Now, World War II was a global war from 1939 to 1945. And the vast majority of the world's countries were, you know, sucked into this conflict, including all of the great powers. You know, you had the Axis powers, Japan, Germany, Italy, and you had the Allied powers, you know, Britain, France, Australia, Canada, the United States, Soviet Union. This was a state of total war involving more than 100 million people from over at least 30 different countries. But you know, when we're considering something like World War II, statistics don't always tell the whole story. You know, a lot of families were personally affected, as was mine. Now, my father had a cousin who lived over in England. My dad's mother was English. She was a Richardson from near London. And, you know, Dad would spend the summers over there in the south of England. He had a cousin whose name was Tony Cowdery. Now, Tony is no longer alive, but some years ago when my wife and I were visiting London, we went down to see my relatives in the south. And as Tony invited us into his home, he showed us a tiny little ship he had carved. It looked like ivory. Well, that tiny ship was carved from one of his own bone fragments. See, Tony was partially crippled by a Nazi Luftwaffe bombing raid. You know, if the German planes during the Battle of Britain, if they couldn't make their way all the way up to London, they would indiscriminately drop their bomb loads on innocent villages in the south of England. My cousin Tony was a victim of that. Now, I know that I believe Mr. Arthur Suckling was in England at that time, and I know this is a normal protocol, Mr. Suckling, but I don't know if you had any kind of observation or comment about that time that you'd like to make.
Thank you very much. Going back into history, nobody likes to hear old men talk about what happened when they were young. But this period of time was a very formative time in my life. We lived in London at the top of an old Victorian house. We had three rooms. We shared the bathroom on the middle floor. And things were very, very poor. I didn't know my father because he was away in India and Burma during World War II. His story is rather very sad because he ended up fighting the Japanese in the jungles of Burma. Got very, very sick, amoebic dysentery, finally was taken off the patrol and put in a hospital. And during that time, they were very, very tight because of the front line where he was fighting. And they said, well, we can get you out of here if you can sit up. We'll tie you up in the back of the truck. But, you know, if you can't, then you'll have to wait for some other time. So he said, yes, I think I can sit up. So away he went, and in the back of the truck, and the Japanese were nearby. And the driver said, Japaniwala, Japaniwala, which is, Wala is a Japanese man. And my father said, don't drive so fast, you'll kill us. And, well, the driver didn't slow down, got them out of there. And an hour afterwards, the hospital was attacked and everyone was slaughtered in there. So he brought these memories home to us as children. Didn't know my father because we'd never seen my father. And one day this man came into the house and my brother Paul and I went and hid behind a chair. We hid behind a chair because who on earth was this stranger coming into our home? Well, it was our father. But my first memory, if you can think about this, what is your first memory that you have right from the very beginning when you were young? Excuse me. My first memory was sitting in a little high chair in this little Victorian house up on the top, and my mother grabbed me out of the chair. I was eating a bowl of porridge. I had a spoon in my hand, and she grabbed me so quickly that the spoon and went back like that, and it stuck against the door. Remember it vividly. And she pushed me in the corner. She grabbed my brother and pushed him in the corner. And just after that, a V1 bomb went over the house and blew up a row of houses about, say, 7,500 yards away. Those became our playground. Mother held us up to the window to see the aeroplanes, flying over London to bomb Germany. So we don't realise the terrible impact that war has, and as you can tell, I feel emotional about this, the terrible impact that war has upon everyone. It affected my father terribly. He smoked and drank himself to death. Tragic story. We buried him at 65. And who knows what stories he went through. He told me one or two, which I won't repeat for the sake of time. But very, very clearly, this time of great trouble, who knows where we are in the world today. I recommend a book, by the way, called The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe, which talks about the period of time when war comes on a regular basis and humanity never, ever has solved its problems. So those are just a few of my memories as a child in World War II in London. And there are many other things I could say, but thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for those comments, Mr. Suckling. That was quite moving. Appreciated that. My dad passed away in December of 2017. That was a little over a year ago. And at his funeral, the U.S. Veterans Association provided a military salute. You know, had two uniformed soldiers marched in and presented my mother with an American flag, folded flag, and they played Taps. My dad landed on Utah Beach in Normandy, France, in the summer of 1944. He was part of the U.S. Armed Forces that marched across Europe, right into the heart of Germany, to put an end to this murderous regime of Adolf Hitler. Back then, if you were living in Europe, if you were Jewish, that entitled you to have all of your wealth and all of your possessions stripped away, and also entitled you to be shipped to a concentration camp, possibly put into a gas chamber. Well, as was typical of the greatest generation, my dad didn't really like to talk about the war. You know, I used to ask him about it. He'd say, "Well, Steve, there's really nothing to tell." Well, thankfully, before he passed away, with the insistent urging of my mother, we did sit down and I was able to fill 1.5 cassette tapes with his memories of World War II, and there was quite a bit to tell. Now, my mother lives back in Philadelphia. Now, she's almost 90 now, and she remembers being a little girl when the attack on Pearl Harbor took place. She tells me, "Well, You know, it happened on a Sunday, and we all went running for our maps and atlases because nobody had ever heard of Pearl Harbor before. Nobody knew where it was. But Mom had an older brother. His name was Jack. He's my Uncle Jack. I knew him quite well. He passed away some years ago. But Uncle Jack, the day, it was either the Monday or the Tuesday after Pearl Harbor, he and two of his buddies raced down to the U.S. Marine recruiting station in Philadelphia and enlisted in the war effort. It was a different era back then. There was actually a spirit of patriotism in this country. Well, little did my uncle know what he's getting himself into. I'd like to read just briefly, before my Uncle Jack died, he left me a copy of his memoirs of an actual battle that he was involved in. And I'll just read briefly from this. You know, he finds himself on a transport ship in the South Pacific. And he writes, I quote, "It was 3:30 a.m. on the morning of November 20th, 1943, and we were standing at our debarkation stations while our sergeant firmly but quietly called the roll. Ahead of us, I could see bright fires that our bombardment had started. I kept watching and cheering at every shell burst. I, along with the other men in my boat, shouted and pointed high as the arching, glowing shells made their way for the island. No one could live through that, I found myself shouting. This is going to be easy. This would become known as the Battle of Tarawa." Dropping down in his memoir here, "Dawn had now crept into the sky, and with it came new sounds. And now came my first rude awakening. I was watching the flight of three Grumman Hellcats, and those are American fighter planes, going in for a strafing run, when suddenly a lead plane disappeared in a flash and a cloud of smoke. I stared unbelievingly at that spot. They couldn't be fighting back. Even if any of them are still alive, they must be shell-shocked, I told myself." How long it took me to wade those 800 yards to the beach, I'll never know. I can only remember the dull feeling of disbelief, the feeling that I was outside, looking in on a scene from a Cecil B. DeMille film. How to describe it? The shouts, the curses, the cries, the screams of the men as they waded resolutely forward or dropped dead or wounded in their tracks. The roar of the planes or the scream of the bombs that shook the island beneath our feet when they exploded with a deafening crescendo. The spouts of water evenly spaced as machine gun bullets etched a path across the water. And the little groups of men who would be thrown in every direction when a shell exploded in their midst. The acrid smell that burned our eyes and lungs caused us to gasp for breath. The sickening smell of death and decay, polluting the air and permeating our clothing, embedding itself into our very pores, and the ever-present feeling that death for you was very near." Well, my uncle writes, "Now it is mid-afternoon, and for the first time since early that morning, I am aware of the pain in my arm and my leg." The war was over for my Uncle Jack. He was shipped off to a military hospital in New Zealand to recover from his wounds. On that beach of Tarawa that morning, 931 U.S. Marines were killed. 2,100 U.S. Marines were injured. Among those was my Uncle Jack. Well, certainly not
a very pleasant thing for anyone to have to live through, but something very clearly prophesied by Jesus Christ to occur at the end of the age. You know, these are just some examples of what happens in the wars that Jesus prophesied. Mankind, apart from God, does not know the way to peace. Now, 2,000 years ago, there was a Jewish preacher in Roman-occupied Palestine who traveled around the countryside with his 12 disciples. He taught. He performed great miracles. He clearly acknowledged that he was the Son of God. He was eventually turned over by his own high priests to be executed by the Romans. Of course, something we memorialize each year during the Passover season. But before Jesus Christ departed from planet Earth, you know, he gave his disciples a commission. That's found in Matthew 28 and verse 18. You can take a look at that. Matthew 28 and verse 18, often known as the Great Commission. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." Now, if one looks carefully at world history, you can certainly see the hand of God is moving and has moved in fulfillment of these prophecies. Starting around the 16th century, under the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, the British Empire began to send explorers and colonizers around the world. They were sent to India, Indonesia, Singapore. They were sent to the Middle East, to South Africa, Rhodesia, and the Caribbean. Back then, it was said the sun never set on the British Empire. And of course, 13 colonies were founded on the eastern seaboard of what would become the United States of America. But the point is, wherever the British went, they took not only the English language with them, but they also took their King James Bible with them. You know, "Go ye therefore into all corners of the world." Of course, we don't believe that the brand of Christianity that those British missionaries took out or that the Roman Catholic Church took, we don't believe that was the faith once delivered to the saints. But nevertheless, from the sense of God's Word, the Holy Bible, God's truth going into all the world, this has very clearly been a mission accomplished, as the Bible has now been translated into virtually every language on earth. So let's ask the question, what lies ahead in the year 2019. You know, last week I happened to see an email in my inbox. It was one of those sponsored content ads that somehow make their way to you, but I clicked on this particular one. And it read, "Collapse 2019, sounding the alarm bells. Former U.S. Congressman Robert E. Bauman issues dire warning that an unstoppable economic collapse has already been triggered." He goes on to mention, you know, $20 trillion of national debt and the Federal Reserve and the U.S. dollar losing its reserve status. Of course, the bottom of these emails, there's usually
some kind of financial report or financial service which is being sold, as was the case here. But what's going to happen in 2019? Well, I don't think any of us knows for sure, but there certainly are some very clear indications that we're going to have more turbulence, we're going to have more upsets, we're going to have more division in our nation, we're going to have more chaos and confrontation, certainly at the level of our national government. We've seen that just this past week with the fight over the wall and the shutdown and the State of the Union address. Now, some like to think that they can predict the future in minute detail. But I do believe it's very difficult for us to pinpoint exactly how and when end time Bible prophecies will be fulfilled. Jesus did say, no man knows the day or the hour. And I think the Apostle Paul's words in 1 Corinthians could be applied here as well, where he says, for now we see through a glass darkly. It's a little bit murky. It's a little bit unclear. Now, earlier this month, up in Denver, and we were able to tune in on the webcast that particular day for Sabbath services, and Mr. Randy Hoosier gave a sermonette on Philippians 4, verse 13. In that sermonette, Randy talked about the development of mega churches in our country that preach the health and wealth gospel, you know, the power of positive thinking. There's one of those ministries in particular that he mentioned. That was the ministry of Joel Osteen. He's a televangelist out of Houston, Texas. Actually has millions of viewers who tune in to his program to hear his messages each and every week. And you know, if you listen to Mr. Osteen, certainly love and, you know, treating your neighbor well is a part of the gospel message. The life of Jesus Christ is an important part of the gospel message, something that we will focus on in the months ahead coming into Passover season. But you know, one or two verses that you would probably not hear from Mr. Osteen, you'd probably not hear in one of those mega churches, is the one that I'd like for us to look at right now. And once again, it's back in Matthew 24, Jesus' Olivet prophecy. Matthew 24, verse 21. Jesus again here is speaking of the end times. And quite honestly, for us in modern day 21st century America, with our high standard of living, plenty of food in the refrigerator, this is not the most pleasant thing to consider. You know, it doesn't fit in well with that health and wealth gospel that these mega churches teach. Jesus said in verse 21, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. Jesus of Nazareth gave us an accurate forecast of what it would be like in the end time. Let's look at the parallel verse. That's in Daniel 12 and verse 1. Daniel 12 and verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. Everyone was found written in the book. Well, brethren, as we come to a close,
Not too long ago, I was visiting some old friends down in Southern California. Some friends I went to college with, some that are no longer believers, some that think we're crazy for carrying on with the work like we do. But there's one individual that I stay friendly with. We get together whenever I go down there, and we were having lunch one day, and somehow he steered the conversation onto end of the world prophecies and the beast power. I think he was reminiscing about the old Plain Truth magazine. And he turned to me and he said, "Steve, so what?" He said, "So what? Even if it is true, there's not really anything I can do about it now, is there?" Well, you know, that attitude is incorrect, because there is something that we can do. Let's look at Luke 21. Verse 36. Jesus told his disciples this, and it certainly still applies today. "Watch therefore, and pray always, that you may be counted to escape all these things that will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man." Well, brethren, we all have our spiritual responsibilities that become even more serious with the passage of time. You and I have been called out at a very important juncture in world history. God has placed us here in His church for a purpose. Now, at the beginning, I referred to Michael Savage and his book, Stop Mass Hysteria, where he says, we live in an age of hate. Well, we can thank God that ultimately there will be an end to war, and ultimately there is a bright future ahead for man on planet Earth. So let's look at just one last verse. We drop back to Luke 21 and verse 28. Luke 21, verse 28. "Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near." Jesus Christ is known in the Scripture as a Savior. And that is exactly what mankind will need to survive at some point in the future. Well, with that, brethren, I'd like to wish for all of you a productive and a meaningful year ahead in 2019, and that we in the Church of God might live in a state of righteousness and truth and in service to the living God.